Sponsorship of the KQED live audio stream comes from Stanford Continuing Studies. This winter, join Professor Alexander Nemirov for Outlandish Life, Peter Paul Rubens and the Baroque, exploring the dramatic art of the 17th century. Learn more at continuingstudies.stanford.edu.
From Futuro Media and PRX, it's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Today, a special episode in collaboration with Futuro Investigates and the Marshall Project. We traveled to rural Georgia to spend 48 hours inside El Refugio. It's a hospitality house for families of detainees at the Stewart Detention Center.
He doesn't have any reason to be detained. I was devastated when he told me.
We learn how this place acts as a kind of lifeline for families of people held in ICE custody, how the volunteers keep tabs on conditions inside the detention center, and what's changed under Trump.
Every weekend that I come down here, I play up scenarios in my mind about what could possibly happen.
All this coming up on Latino USA. Stay with us. No te vayas.
Live from NPR News, I'm Janine Herbst. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth hasn't published video of the follow-on strike on an alleged drug boat, despite President Trump backing the release. NPR's Luke Garrett reports one lawmaker who has seen the footage says Hegseth doesn't want the public to see it.
House Armed Services Committee ranking member Adam Smith got to watch the video of the strike on survivors of an attack on an alleged drug boat in the Caribbean. Smith, a Democrat from Washington State, called the tape, quote, deeply disturbing on ABC News.
It seems pretty clear they don't want to release this video because they don't want people to see it, because it's very, very difficult to justify.
But Republican Senator Eric Schmidt of Missouri told ABC News that the early September follow-on strike and those that followed were all legal.
They're going to carry out their mission. They executed another strike of a narco-terrorist just this past week. Those will continue, and they're completely authorized. I reviewed the 40-plus page memo by the Office of Legal Counsel.
Over the weekend, Hegseth said the Pentagon is reviewing the strike footage to determine if it can be released. Luke Garrett, NPR News, Washington.
Elon Musk's X has kicked the European Commission out of a key system for buying and tracking ads. NPR's Bobby Allen reports it follows a $140 million fine against X by European regulators.
Musk's X announced it had terminated the European Commission's access to its ad system, accusing EU officials of abusing an ad tool to boost a post about its hefty fine against Musk. It comes just days after the Commission fined X for issues including deceptive design practices over its paid blue check feature. It allows anyone to pay for so-called verification. EU regulators said that exposes users to scams, manipulation, and the spread of misleading content. Since the fine, Vice President J.D. Vance has attacked the move as punishing Musk for not engaging in censorship sought by European regulators. Europe's crackdown on X and other social media sites has reignited tensions with Washington over the future of free speech online. Bobby Allen, PR News.
Hong Kong authorities have vowed a transparent investigation into one of the deadliest fires in the region. But it's also arresting people who question why the apartment building fire was so deadly, including foreign journalists who wrote about the fire that killed at least 159 people. NPR's Emily Fang has more.
A physical discussion board run by the student union at Hong Kong Baptist University posted notes calling for government accountability in the deadly fire. That board was then boarded up itself, and the student union's operations have now been suspended. Over the weekend, Hong Kong National Security Police also arrested a man who they said posted, quote, seditious materials after he wrote criticism of the government online over the fire. Many residents of the buildings which caught fire say they complained about fire risks for months leading up to the tragedy. Emily Fang, NPR News.
You're listening to NPR News from Washington. 3 days of talks between U.S. and Ukrainian negotiators wrapped up in Florida with no major breakthrough. Ukrainian President Zelensky is set to talk with European Union leaders tomorrow about terms of a peace deal. Meanwhile, Russia launched another missile and drone attack on Ukraine's energy infrastructure overnight. The Vatican recently released a report saying that the Catholic Church shouldn't ordain women as deacons. As NPR's Sarah Ventry reports, deacons assist priests and can baptize, witness marriages, and preside at funerals.
The commission was originally set up by Pope Francis to examine the possibility of allowing women to serve as deacons. The group included both men and women, and the report cited arguments both for and against. Ellie Hidalgo is with the group Discerning Deacons.
This report doesn't actually change what's happening on the ground, but it is a call for us to continue to make visible how women are already responding to the Holy Spirit's call to ministry.
The report also says there is a need to create new lay ministries for women. Now it's up to Pope Leo to decide the church's next steps, which could include more discussion and discernment. Sarah Ventry, NPR News.
At the weekend box office, Five Nights at Freddy's 2 debuted in the top spot with an estimated $63 million in ticket sales. It's the biggest opening ever for the weekend after Thanksgiving, and it's the largest for a PG-13 movie this year. I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. RWJF is a national philanthropy working toward a future where health is no longer a privilege, but a right. Learn more at rwjf.org.
This week at KQED.org, you can meet two Bay Area teenagers who are mapping the movements of coyotes in Silicon Valley, plus information about how to understand your options for paying back student loans, that and so much more at KQED.org. More fog, low-hanging tule fog in store for tonight, very chilly temperatures and light winds. This is KQED News.
Welcome to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Senior producer Julieta Martinelli is going to start our show.
It's just past 8 a.m. on a rainy Saturday morning in late August. We're at the back of a large white house with dark green shutters, bordered by a manicured yard with flowers.
Hey. Good morning.
Hi. I'm with reporter Shannon Heffernan of the Marshall Project, the nonprofit news organization covering the U.S. criminal justice system. I'll be reporting with her for the next 2 days here in Southwest Georgia.
Yeah. Sorry, the rain got us.
Yeah, I see.
A woman with long grayish white hair named Marilyn opens the door for us. We walk directly into an airy kitchen where she and four other women are huddling around a kitchen island. Once introductions are made, they get right back to business.
And everybody's got their ID.
The smell of brewing coffee permeates the air.
I had a dream last night that I pulled out my ID and it was like cut in half and everything. It's my first time, so.
That's Katie, a sandy blonde with a soft laugh. Another woman, her name is Amy, cuts in.
No, I had to check like 40 times. I was like, I know it's gone. My ID's gone. I never move it, but it's gone.
It's clear that this kind of oddly specific anxiety dream is shared amongst these women. That's because these five people standing around the kitchen today are all volunteers in this home. And this is not a regular house. It's a hospitality house called El Refugio, or the refuge in Spanish. The home is open on weekends year-round. It provides a free place to eat, rest, and sleep for families who travel long hours to visit loved ones at a nearby immigration detention center nestled deep within this rural part of the state. And as we soon learn, the dreams of lost or cut IDs are really not so random. They're getting ready to get inside the Stewart Immigration Detention Center to visit with people in ICE custody.
And you've been like put in this place where nobody can see you, and it's just nice. Somebody just recognizes you as like a human.
That's Amy again.
And I don't know, our country's like been dehumanizing all these people, and just to hear their story, or it's be like, I see you.
Just 2 miles away from El Refugio, down narrow roads surrounded by a forest of green, sits one of the largest immigration detention centers in the country. On average, it houses around 2,000 people in custody, more people than it's built to accommodate. Despite its massive size, it's a detention center that, unless you're from the South, you're probably less likely to have heard about the way you may have heard of others on the news, especially lately.
Anti-ICE protests outside LA's Metropolitan Detention Center have become a flashpoint.
And we're following some breaking news. Protesters are gathering outside a Chicago detention center where hundreds of migrants are being held.
Protesters gathering in Charlotte, North Carolina tonight, angered by the Trump administration's decision to deploy federal immigration agents to their city.
There are fewer demonstrations out here or clashes between protesters and ICE. There is simply a fading rural town in southwest Georgia. There are no grocery stores, no place for visitors to stay the night, and less than 1,000 residents in the whole town. That's one of the reasons that the volunteers are so eager to get inside, to keep an eye on what's happening with detainees inside Stewart, and to share a bit of human warmth.
All right, thanks again, you guys.
Yeah.
The volunteers shuffle out of the house. It's 8:15 now, and visitations have already started.
Oh, it's so bad.
Really? Right?
Is it raining?
But I don't even have an umbrella, a jacket, nothing. I might just hear vibes.
They run out the back door, down a long wooden ramp, past a colossal pear tree overflowing with ripe fruit, down to their cars parked in a gravel driveway.
All right, we'll see you guys when you get back.
We're going to be spending the next 48 hours inside El Refugio with the families that pass through here and the volunteers that run this hospitality house to learn how this place is handling and adapting to the onslaught of immigration arrests in the second Trump term and to hear directly from the families of the people that have gotten swept up in the raids.
It's Latino USA, and for this story, we traveled down to South Georgia to spend 48 hours at El Refugio, a one-of-a-kind hospitality house created in order to ease the burden for people who are visiting loved ones at one of the country's largest immigration detention centers. We're going to meet families whose lives have been turned upside down by ICE, and also meet the volunteers that are helping them navigate the system. We also learn about the different ways that ramped up ICE enforcement is leading more people than ever into places like the Stewart Detention Center in Georgia. Today's episode is a collaboration between Latino USA, Futuro Investigates, and the Marshall Project. Senior producer Julieta Martinelli, who started us off, traveled to Stewart County, Georgia, with reporter Shannon Heffernan in order to produce this story. I'm going to hand the mic to Julieta now. And just a heads up, dear listener, this story contains some mentions of suicide. So take care while listening.
The grapes and the bread came out of the refrigerator.
Back inside El Refugio, things are still quiet. Marilyn, the woman who opened the door for us, has stayed behind to prepare for the day's visitors. Marilyn is the house coordinator this weekend.
Here is some peach bread that I brought for our breakfast, and then halos.
Marilyn takes note of the food in the fridge, and then she goes through the pantry. She makes plans for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. As she opens cabinets, I notice one item that is in large supply.
Pencil beans, baked beans, pork beans, black beans, more different types of pencil beans.
Yeah, vegetarian beans.
Vegetarian beans.
Yeah, we got big pencil.
It's almost comical.
You know, people are so kind, and they donate what they imagine could be useful.
While Stewart Detention Center doesn't publish their demographics, reports show that the majority of detainees are Latinos. Their presence has even shifted the demographics of this rural area. A 2016 analysis of census data by Pew Research Center claimed that Stewart County saw the largest growth in Latino population in America and noted that the detention center was likely the reason. And Latinos? Well, a lot of us do really love beans.
So in this cabinet, we have lots of different teas. We have some honey, some coffee, breakfast cereals.
While they accept non-perishable donations like these, volunteers do still need to shop for fresh food every weekend. And because there are no grocery stores in Lumpkin, Marilyn and the volunteers lug groceries down from Atlanta, where they live several hours north. It's just become part of the routine.
The house has been operating for 15 years.
Wow.
And then prior to that, there were group visitations that were organized a few times a year. So I did some of those.
Stewart was first opened in 2006 by CoreCivic, then known as Corrections Corporation of America. Marilyn said after it opened, she and other volunteers from an advocacy group started coming down to visit detainees. This was around the time that ICE enforcement really ramped up in the state. By 2011, Stewart was considered the largest and the busiest immigration detention center in the nation. The following year, Stewart was sued by the ACLU of Georgia in a filing that said Stewart had proven, quote, incapable of protecting the basic human rights of immigrants under its care. The report cited a number of claims relating to abuse, inhumane conditions, and failure to meet medical and legal standards. And then there was the location. Marilyn says driving down a Lumpkin for visitations made the advocates realize just how challenging this detention center's geographic isolation was for the families that were visiting.
So that was really the impetus for starting this work, knowing that by giving people a place to stay over a Saturday night, we could really serve people's needs.
That's why, around 15 years ago, the first hospitality house in Lumpkin was opened. It was originally established by an immigrants' rights nonprofit called Alterna. Marilyn was a part of it. By 2012, El Refugio became its own nonprofit, and a group of founding members, including Marilyn, took over managing the house. They were originally at a smaller house. Over the following years, visitors at El Refugio continued to grow. In 2018, they moved over to this larger house where we are today. Marilyn finishes in the kitchen and walks us over to the living room / waiting area. She adjusts the pillows on a comfortable couch. I see art on the walls, books and board games on the shelves. She talks as she continues her routine.
I mean, every weekend that I come down here, I play out different scenarios in my mind about what could possibly happen.
Yeah. Has it felt like that's gotten more intense as of late?
Oh, sure.
That's Marshall Project reporter Shannon.
Sure.
As we talk, Marilyn guides us over to a large map on a wall.
Here's our map. We've got people to indicate where they're from. So,
oh, wow.
Yeah, so you can see.
Look at this. It's everywhere.
So this is both volunteers and guests who come to the house.
Can you describe the concentration of the pins?
A whole lot of pins in the Southeast United States, in Mexico and through Central America, quite a few, Colombia, Venezuela, Ecuador, a smattering of pins across Africa and a few across Europe, several in Asia, a couple in Pakistan and India, 1, 2, 3, 4 in Iran, some from Israel-Palestine, several from Australia. Yeah, so.
Seeing it like this, it's really kind of mind-blowing. People from all over the world have passed through this house because people from all over the world have been sent down here into ICE detention. In less than a year, the Trump administration has increased the number of people detained in ICE facilities by almost 50%. In fact, the first week of November broke a record with more than 66,000 people in ICE custody nationwide. More than any time in American history, ever. And really, That's why we're here. As more and more people get taken into ICE custody and moved into massive detention centers isolated in rural areas like Stewart, it becomes even harder to know what people are going through inside. A hospitality house like this serves another important role, a common place for family members of detained individuals to gather and share information. It's hard to know how many people to expect this weekend. Marilyn says that you never really quite know. Just in case, though, they've prepared all the rooms. We walked through a dining room with one of the largest tables I've ever seen. Marilyn says that most people congregate here throughout the day. There are several bedrooms with multiple beds along two floors. Everywhere I look, there's colorful art with encouraging messages. It's a lively, happy place.
Oh, hi.
Hi. Hey, this is my husband.
Our tour is cut short around 9 a.m. The first visitors.
For hours until 2 o'clock, sometimes we can come in Maryland. Nice to meet you. I came like a year or 2 weeks ago.
Oh, great.
Yeah, great. Hi.
Her name is Brooke. She's visiting her husband.
Are you two together for a year? My sister-in-law.
Okay, great.
So you know that.
The women stop by the prison first. It's how the routine goes, we learn. The visitation hours are split based on gender. Who goes first depends on the day. Today, Saturday, it was men in the afternoon, from 2 to 8 p.m. But as families have learned the hard way, you can't just show up on time.
But I know, like, the time gets full fast, so we had to come here early to sign on the list to visit in the afternoon. So we're part of group one.
Right? Visits at Stewart happen behind a thick plexiglass. People like Brooke will travel for hours just to talk to their loved ones through a phone. Families can't hug or even hold hands. And even though the government claims that detention centers are not prisons, it all looks and feels the same. Now that she's safely on the list and there's a few hours to kill, Brooke and her family can finally rest. They thank the volunteers and make their way to one of the bedrooms.
Yep. Make yourselves at home.
Okay.
And let us know if you need anything.
Thank you.
Marilyn says that a lot of what they end up doing is filling in new visitors with these kinds of nuances around visitation.
Coming up on Latino USA, we meet some of the families passing by El Refugio on their way to the Stewart Immigration Detention Center. And we learn how these detentions have changed their lives. Stay with us. No te vayas.
Support for KQED comes from Xfinity, delivering smart Wi-Fi, mobile, home security, and entertainment to help power a seamlessly connected life. Learn more at Xfinity.com. Xfinity, imagine that. Hidden Brain coming up at 7 o'clock.
In the early days of the COVID-19 pandemic, a movie that had been released years earlier became a surprise hit. It was a film about a global pandemic.
On the Warner Brothers catalog, I think it was ranked 270, and it had shot up to being the second most popular movie on the catalog overnight.
Why we're drawn to dark and scary stories, this week on Hidden Brain from NPR.
That's at 7 o'clock every Sunday evening. And KQED Arts, all about Bay Area theater, a look back of this year. A lot of standout moments, including Joan Baez at the Circus, The Soiled Dove. Or how about The Tempest at the Point Montara Lighthouse? Check it out at kqed.org/arts.
Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Before the break, we met some of the families transitioning through El Refugio. It's a hospitality house for those visiting their loved ones at an immigration detention center in rural Georgia. Senior producer Julieta Martinelli brings us this story today, so let's get back to it.
Not being allowed inside, not having the right clothes or ID, those are the kinds of anxieties that also plagued Maria during her first visit. It's nearly noon when I meet her. after she walks in with her mom and her toddler, Kehlani.
How old are you? What's my name is?
Dosh.
Kehlani attempts to sign the number 2 with her fingers. She has her hair in pigtails and wears these bright purple sunglasses. Maria has been coming down a store for several weeks now. But today is the first time that she's visiting El Refugio.
Today I'm here to come and visit my fiancé. He has been in Stewart Detention Center since July 20th. On July 20th, the whole world changed. He was going to work. Sorry, I get emotional. For 2 years, I was a stay-at-home mom watching our daughter. He was the provider for our family, not just like our family, his mom and dad in Mexico, too.
It's now been nearly 6 weeks since our fiancé, Luis, was detained.
He was going to work. It was 8 o'clock, and he calls me at 8:30. He's like, hey, I was picked up by ICE. I was just putting her back to sleep. And I was like, what do you mean? And I went to go check outside. But by that time, he was already gone. He's like, hey, I know it's a lot. Just listen. He's like, the officer was nice enough to let me know that he was arrested.
Maria says that they snatched him up somewhere between his front door and his car. She says they showed him a photo, but he never saw a warrant or any documents to explain why they were picking him up. It didn't matter. Technically, under the law, ICE should arrive with judicial warrants to pick up the people that they're there to detain, especially if they want to enter a business or a residence. But they can also legally detain people with, quote, reasonable suspicion in public places, according to DHS. And the Supreme Court recently validated this, basically giving ICE carte blanche to racially profile people in public. Maria tells me that Luis was simply put in a car and taken away. Just like that.
It's really hard with the new laws. I am a U.S. resident. We just got engaged last year in August. We're going to get married in September. That was our plan. We've been together for 12 years.
You're going to get married in a month?
Yeah. So this September, we were going to get married. You really never think this is going to happen to you. You just hear it on the news. You hear like, oh, blah, blah, blah. And you never think it's going to hit you like this.
All those preparations over the last year suddenly didn't matter. The emotional impact of Luis's arrest was instant. The family was distraught. Then came the next challenge.
The money, the financial burden of this. Like I said, I was a stay-at-home mom, now trying to figure out who. Thank God we have savings. But again, that only takes you so long. So you really have to like think.
Maria looks at Kehlani. She's running around in the waiting area, eating a banana that she picked out in the kitchen.
It's been emotional for her because her life has changed in less than a month. She was with me 24 hours. She's really smart, but she does have speech delay. So we were really focusing on her speech delay, trying to get her teeth, like all of that. So right now we have stopped the therapy because I need to figure out my schedule. So now we're just accommodating to their new normal.
The new normal means 3-hour drives to Stewart on the weekends. Maria says that they've been waiting for a bond hearing for over a month. She fears that Luis will be pushed into a fast-track deportation. That sense of overwhelm, of chaos, it's something that we hear about from nearly every person on this day. As the hours pass, people shuffle in and out of El Refugio. Later in the afternoon, around 2 p.m., as the second round of visitations began at Stewart, the line of people shuffling in and out of El Refugio slows down. Marilyn is back in the kitchen.
Goldfish, fruit snacks, mini muffins.
Mini muffins. We got some Nutri-Grain bars.
There's a Ziploc bag of lentil soup in there that is vegan, so I'm going to pull that out.
Okay.
Later, two women walk through the door. They're both wearing jeans and white tops, a blonde and a brunette chatting. They clearly came here together.
After they get settled in, I approach the women as they talk quietly at the dining room table, drinking coffee. They tell me they're grateful to be navigating the complexity of immigration detention together. And so are their husbands. Alma, the brunette, and Anna, the blonde, are friends. Well, they are now. Their husbands were co-workers. They're both painters. Now, they're locked up together at Stewart.
Él y un compañero venían del trabajo y venían en una van de trabajar.
Alma says they were on their way to work a few weeks ago. A third co-worker was driving. They were just a couple miles away from their job site in a wealthy suburb in Atlanta. The men stopped at a gas station just as they did every other day. They pumped gas, grabbed coffee, and made their way back to their work van. They spotted a cop watching them. The minute they pulled out, police lights.
Y pues el policía al verlos, por su apariencia de hispanos, pues el policía los siguió.
Alma thinks that they were racially profiled. Both women say that, according to their husbands, the cops never told them why he pulled them over.
No les dio ticket ni nada, simplemente.
Instead, she says the cop asked if they were legal. It was an odd question, according to Alma, because she says that the driver had provided a driver's license.
Nada, simplemente lo único que hizo fue llamarles a las personas estas y los detuvieron, los llevaron a Atlanta.
Alma says that the officer stepped back and made a phone call. Then she says the men saw a car parked across the street at a fire station pull around behind them.
Mi esposo me comenta que esas personas estaban en una estación de bomberos.
They say the officer greeted the masked men who exited the unmarked car.
No traían nada de placa de policía.
There were no decals, badges, or identification, just men in a car. This is something that we've seen often this year after Trump took office, and something that keeps popping up in Latino USA's reporting, no matter what state we're in. ICE agents in unmarked vehicles. They show up out of nowhere, snatch people up without paperwork or explanation, and take them into custody. It all happens so quickly.
Era un carro particular, y a los cinco minutos que los paró la policía, a los cinco minutos llegó, nunca fueron al departamento de policía, ellos fueron directamente al departamento de ICE.
Alma says it took less than 5 minutes between being pulled over to the moment that they were taken by ICE. They were sent directly to the processing facility in Atlanta, then eventually here. Alma leads the storytelling. Anna, sitting next to me at the table, can't stop wiping her tears. At some point, someone places a container of Kleenex in front of her. The balled-up tissues pile around us on the table. But Alma is angry. She wonders, was the cop unofficially working with ICE? Why not take them into the local jail if they did something wrong? They're valid questions. While in Georgia, a new state law requires local sheriff's departments to check the legal status of people taken into custody, there are rules and policies to follow. The person must be charged with something and processed at the local jail before being placed on an ICE hold.
Si mi esposo en ese momento le hubiera dicho a ellos, saben que yo tengo una petición y mi esposa tiene todos los documentos, déjenme le hablo que ella los muestre. Hasta si eso se hubiera podido hacer.
Alma says her husband should have never been taken in. He has an open petition for adjustment of status.
Yo no le deseo a nadie lo que yo estoy viviendo, lo que Ana está viviendo, la incertidumbre, ¿qué vamos a hacer? ¿Qué vamos a hacer? ¿Nos vamos a quedar aquí? ¿O nos vamos a ir a México? ¿Qué vamos a hacer?
The hardest part, Alma says, is not knowing what's going to happen. Will they be able to get their partners out? Will they get deported? Will the women have to abandon everything they've built here and return to Mexico? Do they want to? Will they have to?
Vivimos porque tenemos que vivir, pero si no.
Yo voy a buscar a alguien que me ayude a rentar un cuarto porque yo sola no puedo, la verdad.
Alma and Anna are both looking to rent out rooms in their homes. Alma says she fears for her safety, so she's trying to hold out to find a female tenant. After our chat, Alma and Anna head off to Stuart to visit their husbands. But first, they go to the bathroom. They touch up their hair. They smile and put on a facade that they're okay, that they're strong. Volunteers keep a tally of the people passing through. They used to keep a list. Families who walked in would put their loved ones' names down and share contact information. Volunteers would follow up on their cases, make visits, and try to stay informed. It's how they could get a sense of how processes were changing, a general idea of how long it took to get a bond hearing, to get transferred, released, or even deported. But now, that's too risky. After 15 years here, volunteers say that for the first time, they fear that ICE will show up at El Refugio. So, since Trump took office, they just stopped keeping track. They also lock their doors now, something that Marilyn says feels wrong, but necessary.
I see that you have your caution signs up here.
That's reporter Shannon again.
Have you ever had anybody actually come to the door looking for people?
No. Yeah. But it's something that we're prepared for.
The volunteers have even been recently trained and even ran practice drills on what to do if ICE shows up. Run to the door, make sure it's locked, ask for a warrant, make sure it's a judicial warrant, don't open the door, don't say anything, be quiet, and...
Please start recording.
Immediately.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. That's just saying that somebody is walking past them.
Ah, got it.
As if on cue, a chime plays over a speaker, a motion sensor. At this point, my reporting partner, Shannon, asks,
have you tried to be pretty careful about security and stuff like that?
You know, balancing hospitality and safety is a really, really difficult dance. Our home is open to anybody who comes to us asking for hospitality. At the same time, we have to make sure that there is a clear boundary there between what's public space and what's private space, and that we don't allow anyone into this space who has ill intentions. And that includes more than just ICE, right?
Marilyn says she follows the news closely. So it's not really surprising to hear of this fear. After all, there has been a rise in reports of attacks on immigrants and even people masquerading as ICE agents to cause them harm.
We've not had that issue at all, but of course, it's top of mind, top of mind.
Coming up on Latino USA, new fears under a new Trump administration. And we enter the second and final day at El Refugio. Stay with us. No te vayas.
Support for KQED comes from Eric and Wendy Schmidt, whose philanthropy works to create a healthy, resilient, secure world for all, on the web at theschmidt.org. We have a chance now to check again into traffic, and let's go to Joe Salvatore. Hi, Joe.
Hi, Beth. We'll start in Fremont on northbound 880 at Automall Parkway. It's a three-car crash. It's blocking the second lane from the left. Traffic is backed up to Fremont Boulevard South. Better news on the Dumbarton Bridge, where we had the right lane shut down from an earlier crash eastbound right around mid-span. All lanes now open on the Dumbarton Bridge. Joe Salvatore for KQED.
Okay, well, thank you so much, Joe. And if you'd like to submit a perspective about something to do with the holidays, are you doing something different? Is there something you really love? Are you visiting a new place? Go to kqed.org/perspectives to get started on submitting your piece today. We would love to hear from you.
Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Senior producer Julieta Martinelli picks up the story from here.
It's dinner time now at El Refugio. After all families have left, volunteers, Marilyn, Amy, Mackenzie, and two Katies, finally sit down over bowls of homemade lentil soup. The house is empty tonight. And they share what they hear about conditions inside. Things like issues accessing commissary and food.
And there seems to be a pretty significant delay between when you order something and when you get it.
Or the failure to provide quality translators, which are integral to a person's immigration case.
The immigration attorney, I know he's had issues with court interpretation. I remember one case he was talking about that he speaks enough Arabic to know if somebody is interpreting it well or not.
Interpreters who don't speak the language well, and other challenges of communication, like with tablets for video visitations, for families without papers, or those who are not able to travel here, this is the only other way to see their loved ones.
The lady I spoke to last time said there's three tablets for her, however many are in her thing, yeah. She said there were 62 people in here.
Nearly impossible to get a chance at video visits. That's why these in-person visits are so important and necessary to families, and also to the volunteers who step in for those who can't visit. It's not easy seeing people in their darkest hours, hearing their stories, wanting to help, but really only being able to listen. After all, each of the volunteers tells us that they ended up here because they were fed up with seeing what they considered cruelty on the news. They wanted to feel useful, to do something.
There was a man here, a man who took his own life at Stewart.
Oh, God.
And I was the house coordinator that weekend.
That's Marilyn again.
We had been told this is a priority visit to have happen. So I was going to go visit him on Saturday, but then his mom came by the house, and she was coming from Stewart, and she said, please, 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 can someone check on my son tomorrow? And I said, yes, I will go check on your son. And he was in segregation at that point.
Segregation refers to a person placed in a protected unit. You might also have heard it called solitary confinement.
So I went over really early to try to visit him.
But Marilyn says that she was told that she couldn't see him.
I went home, and then Monday morning, I got a phone call that he had taken his own life. It was hard. It was hard because I mean, it's not like I felt like my visit could have changed anything, but, you know, it felt personal in a way.
The other volunteers nod their heads. It's a sentiment they seem to share.
His mom knew he needed something.
Yeah.
Across the nation, there have been 20 deaths in ICE custody just this year. In fact, by October, this was already considered the deadliest year for people in ICE custody in two decades. These are the kinds of things that these volunteers have to grapple with. But Amy, one of the volunteers, says that while it's emotionally difficult work, it's helped her feel like at least she's doing something.
People really are like desperate for like tangible ways to help, and it's so confusing right now, like what's actually helpful.
For those who have been here longer though, like one of the Katies who is also a coordinator, the work can take a toll.
I haven't been here in 6 months probably. It's been a while. And I was really beating myself up about it and just kind of like, do I want to come back out? Can I cope with what's, like, I don't know that I'm strong enough to do this work, honestly. Like I just had this big moment of doubt.
Because her Spanish is not that great. And she had a situation where she was unable to communicate with the person.
I have to get out of my own head that I don't have to do it perfectly. I don't have to be the most emotionally available, stable. You know, I don't have to have the most language. Like, I just have to show up.
That's really what it's about here, it seems. Every need can't be fully met. There is chaos, constant changes, people coming in and out, all playing out within a system that is much bigger than this place or these people. But what each of these volunteers say they can do is continue to show up. The next day, no one seems to have got much sleep. It was a long, heavy day. 8 a.m., breakfast is made. Coffee is brewed. By 10, 11, noon, families finishing the first wave of visitations are shuffling in to eat, rest, or nap before they have to do the long drive home. While a lot of visitors have been Latinos, we also met families from Russia, Vietnam, and Gambia passing through the house. On our final day, we also meet a family, a young woman, here with her husband and children, coming to visit her father.
Is this your first time to Stewart?
Yes, ma'am, sure is.
They got a nice set of toys in there, too.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Uh-oh. I'm sure they'll find them.
After the kids get settled, Shannon sits down with them in the front room.
How long has your dad been there?
I'm
sure he's going to be thrilled to see Mom.
Yeah.
She still remembers the day she found out that her father was in ICE custody.
I just got a call from my dad. He said that he was detained by ICE. It definitely caused my surprise because he's not a criminal. He didn't do anything wrong.
Now, they're in the process of trying to deport him to a country that he hasn't been in 43 years.
He doesn't have family there. Everyone is here. Have you gotten any word about how your dad's doing in there?
That's Marshall Project reporter Shannon again.
We're sending him commissary money, and he's eating tuna.
As the conversation continues, it undoubtedly veers towards Trump's policies.
I'm a Republican, and I know that Trump put this in place and stuff, and I did vote for him, but I didn't know. It wasn't just rapists and killers and murders and this and that, like drug traffickers. Like, it was, my dad's not any of that. When Trump was advocating and stuff and campaigning, I had no idea that it was literally about, like, hate, you know? And
you thought when he was talking about immigrants, he wasn't talking about your dad.
No, I was thinking about, like, you know, literally, like, human traffickers and criminals, like, that are hurting other people, you know? I don't want to be around that. I don't want my kids to be around that. That's what he campaigned, and that's what he said and stuff. Yeah, it's very frustrating.
Yeah.
But this experience has changed a lot for her. She says her family no longer supports Trump.
Not just because of my dad's situation, but because I feel it's just dividing, like, the country. You're just being so hateful, you know? And, like, we need more love and, like, understanding and not this. This just causes, like, huge divisions and hurts families and people.
It might be difficult to understand how someone can vote for Trump when their loved one's immigration status is up in the air. But it helps to look at the administration's messaging around immigration enforcement. Trump campaigned on this idea that he would round up criminals and those causing harm to communities. Instead, as we've seen over the last 10 months, ICE has actually done the opposite. Recent data shows that more than 70% of people currently in ICE custody don't have a criminal record. And an analysis by the Vera Institute of Justice shows that in the first 4.5 months of the second Trump administration, ICE booked into detention nearly 120,000 people. That's a 17% increase from the same time period during Trump's first term, and a 46% increase from the same time period under President Biden. Families like this are having to come to terms with the fact that when Trump says criminals, it also means them. As they shuffle out of the house later, I sit in the kitchen talking with two of the volunteers who speak Russian. They've just returned from visitation.
Recently, there have been a few, like four or five Russian-speaking women who have asked for visits. One Russian speaker figures out how to contact us, and then she tells the other Russian speakers or you know, whatever.
While most of the people that they visit are Spanish speakers, there's actually all kinds of language needs.
We had a whole group of men from Cameroon who we were visiting, a couple people from some islands from Latin America, and you know, there's people on our list now from countries in Africa.
It's one of the challenges, and maybe even proof, of the expanding of ICE enforcement into all kinds of communities. And it's led people having to make decisions that they never thought they would. Like Veronica. I first spot her playing a card game at the other end of the dining room table. I make my way to the table.
I also brought Uno cards in my bag.
You want to play with us?
Yeah.
No, we're
gonna fun. Now, for the record, I love Uno. Of course, I can't say no.
You gonna shuffle those?
You guys can.
Wow. Here, you shuffle one. You're good. I'm scared to play with you. I shouldn't have sat down. Who are you guys visiting?
My fiance.
Your fiance.
Yeah.
Veronica drove down from Asheville, North Carolina.
6 hours of a drive every time back and forth. Well, 12 hours in total. They got him in his own immigration appointment. And he doesn't have a criminal record. He doesn't have any reason to be detained. Like, his visas are up to date. We were both surprised. I was really devastated when he told me.
Like many of the stories we heard this weekend, Veronica says that they were following the law. Her fiancé was going to his immigration check-ins, and they were planning to get married. She had never considered that this could happen.
I started screaming. I started crying. I wanted to fill up everything with rage, but I know he needed me as much as I needed him, so I just calmed down.
I watch Veronica as we play the card game. She giggles and laughs and seems pointedly different from others in the house. She's optimistic. And that's because all of this, the visits, the lawyers, the stress, the crying, it's coming to an end.
He made the decision to volunteer to deport himself, so we're going to make that change and just go to Colombia. He said that he'd rather do that and then just try to come back again after this presidency is over and just go from there. And I'm just supporting him. I told him from the beginning, whatever he wants to decide or whatever he feels like it's best for him, we just go from there. I'm going to basically sell everything that I have here, have a couple of monies so I can be over there and just go from there. I'm excited. I'm really excited over everything so we can get reunited again.
Before Veronica leaves, she says she can't wait to get back to living her life. She radiates joy and peace, something that stands out to me after a weekend where we heard so much sadness, fear, and anxiety. Over the past 48 hours, we've spoken to families that have become paralyzed by the sudden presence of ICE in their lives. The detainments have upended everything, not just the lives of the people at Stewart, but that of everyone around them. They're in a form of purgatory, a life-sized version of this home, a waiting room with no set times and no clear next steps. But Veronica and her fiancé are bucking the system. It might look like giving up, and maybe it is. But it's a choice made by them. As the day wraps and our weekend at El Refugio comes to an end, families began to make their way home. I catch my breath outside for a minute and spot one of the volunteers doing the same. It's Mackenzie, the youngest volunteer here this weekend. She's just 21.
I wonder like how that feels for you when like the weekends are drawing to a close. I know it's probably also emotionally taxing.
I think it's nice to have the people come through
and to just see how many people were really helping by being able to keep the house open and like volunteering here, even just to set out the stuff for lunch or make up the beds.
Mackenzie is a student at Spelman, a historically Black women's college in Atlanta, with a rich tradition of civic involvement and community activism.
I think some people like think, oh, this isn't something that I need to be concerned about because it's not in my community. It doesn't affect me. It doesn't affect people that look like me. But when you come here, there's white people, there's Black people, there's Hispanic people, Europeans, Russians.
She's right. This weekend, we spoke with more than 60 people at El Refugio, families from 8 different countries speaking a number of different languages. While we only heard the stories of a handful of families in this piece, we spoke with dozens, most too afraid to share publicly what they're experiencing out of fear of repercussions from the Trump administration.
It's just a good reminder that this is a very diverse and complicated issue, but that ultimately coming up with a better solution, with a better system that's more inclusive, benefits all of us.
And really, at the end of the day, that's why we chose to come here. Because what's happening inside this place, hidden away in a tiny rural town in the south, just a couple miles from an immigration detention center, is bigger than this house. In a way, the stories we heard at El Refugio are just a reflection of the trauma, the chaos, and the challenges facing people across the nation. At a moment in time where it can feel really hard to make sense of reality, of the law, of how power is wielded, of the ways that we can turn on each other, El Refugio stands as a reminder of the ways in which people can choose to come together.
We reached out to Core Civic regarding some of the claims we heard from families of detainees about conditions inside the detention center. A spokesperson for the organization submitted a lengthy response refuting all claims, adding that these allegations were, quote, unfounded and not an accurate representation of Stewart Detention Center today, end quote. Today, our episode was produced by Julieta Martinelli with reporting from Shannon Heffernan. It was edited by Mitra Bonshahi. It's a collaboration between Latino USA, Futuro Investigates, and the Marshall Project. It was mixed by Julia Caruso and Leah Shaw Dameron. Fact-checking for this episode by Roxana Aguirre. Fernanda Echavarri is our managing editor. And special thanks to the dozens of families who shared so much with our journalists during our visit to El Refugio. The Latino USA team also includes Rebecca Ibarra, Reynaldo Leaños Jr., Stephanie LeBeau, Luis Luna, Glorimar Marquez, Monica Morales Garcia, J.J. Rubin, Adriana Rodriguez, and Nancy Trujillo. Benilei Ramirez and I are executive producers. I'm your host, Maria Hinojosa. Hasta la próxima. No te vayas. Chao.
Latino USA is made possible in part by Public Welfare Foundation, catalyzing transformative approaches to justice that are community-led, restorative, and racially just. W.K. Kellogg Foundation, a partner with communities where children come first. And the Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide.
Hidden Brain is coming up next, also an NPR news update just a minute away. Support for KQED comes from PG&E. Wildfires can happen anytime. When a tree or other hazard falls on their power lines, PG&E can turn it off in 1/10 of a second for safety. Learn more at pge.com/EPSS. Well, this week on our Bay Curious podcast, have you ever noticed that old mansion tucked under the eastern span of the Bay Bridge? One listener did, and they want to know nearly everything about it. And Olivia Allen Price was on it, and you can hear the story on our Bay Curious podcast, which you can find wherever you get your podcasts. And don't forget to play their trivia contest, which is in each episode. I'm Beth Heisinger. Be careful of that tule fog, that low-hanging tule fog.